Good morning, everyone. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Let's make sure that's... we are recording this session, but this is a session that's not going to be recorded very well. I just want to make sure that people listening to this, they know that because we are going to break the group into two groups in the beginning, and everything is going to be very hands-on, so the recording might not be as helpful. In any way, I just want to first welcome you to this session. It's a session in data journalism for both beginners and for advanced practitioners. My name is Bernardo Mota. I am with the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. And basically what we are going to be doing here is we are going to divide this session in three parts. The first part, we are going to separate the group in the people who want to learn the basics and the people who already have some idea of what they're doing. So we can talk about those ideas and work specifically with those ideas. And the second part, we are going to have some presentation of more advanced techniques on data journalism. And finally, if we have some time left, I'll show to you a few cool free tools. Because the idea of this session was actually a conversation that I had with Lissy Grossman. And she really wanted us to have something for freelancing journalists and people in small newsrooms who cannot afford the very expensive tools that many of the big rooms have. And we're trying to figure out how to do this because neither Lizzie, not me, nor I, we were data journalism in specifically. So we invited two very, very good people here to talk to you about those things. The first one is Lisa Fong from ProPublica, and the second one is Jamie Smith Hopkins from the Center of for Public Integrity, and they will be the ones guiding the session. And I'm here kind of substituting Lizzie to just give you a few ideas of what you can do to make your output look more professional without wasting too much time and without having to pay a lot of money to access those tools. So the first thing I'm going to ask you to maybe we should do some basic introductions very quickly. And then we are going to ask you to separate in the two groups. So one will be the beginners group that will be sitting here in front, right? And then the more advanced group, we are going to ask you to sit on the back of the room so we can have that discussion. So first...
And if for some reason we're having trouble hearing each other, we'll just go right outside. So we'll work it out.
First, Lisa.
Sure. Yeah, I'm Lisa. I work at ProPublica. I cover the environment there. I've been there for about 6 months, and I can do some basic data journalism, which is why I'm here. But at ProPublica, we actually have a whole team of very, very advanced data people and mapping people and data viz experts. So, you know, I'm very lucky to be in a newsroom like that, but I know most newsrooms are not set up that way and don't have those resources. So what I'm going to be teaching up here is about an hour's worth of very beginner Excel stuff. So if you have never worked with Excel or Google Sheets, or if you have never done things like basic math in Excel, basic functions, sorting and filtering, then you should stick with me and I'll walk you through that. If you're a more advanced Excel or Google Sheets user, you can work with Jamie and she'll walk you through more fun things. And the reason why we're going to use Google Sheets here is because some of you have PCs and some of you have Macs, and Excel, it works slightly differently in those environments. So to avoid all of that chaos, we're just going to use Google Sheets instead.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I'm looking forward to having a discussion with those of you who want to go to the back or possibly right outside to talk through stories and brainstorm, you know, how you might be able to integrate data, or if you've got data, how you might be able to use it, where you can get help if you're working, you're on your own or in a newsroom and you're the only person who's trying to do this stuff. Some of us in bigger newsrooms are in that same boat. I certainly was before I came to the center, so I know how it feels. And then after the hands-on portion, I'll be giving a talk about walking through several stories that use data in different ways to give you ideas about how you might try it out with your own stories.
going to ask you, if you feel like you already have some idea of how to use Google Sheets and you're already a little more advanced, please move to the back of the room, on that close to that exit door there. And if you want to get the basics of Google Sheets and how to work with data and how to organize your information, how to gather the information, please move closer to the front of the room, please. People who are arriving now, we are separating two groups. So if you already have experience with data and Google Sheets, please move to the back. Actually, I think they are going outside. And people who have no experience or just little, very little experience, you can move forward to the front of the room, please.
Thanks for coming at 9 a.m. to learn about Google Sheets. Dedication. Are all of you able to sign into your Google Drive and get to this URL? So there's a problem with the internet, because of course there is. The only internet wireless connection that's working now is the one called Wyndham Guest, but that one is not secure, so there's no password to type in. So if you're uncomfortable with logging into your Gmail using that, I completely understand. Maybe, you know, sit next to someone else who has logged in and is fine with it. I'm actually right now on Jamie's hotspot, which is how I'm getting internet. Oh, crap, I think Jamie took her phone with her. If you are able to get to that spreadsheet, just make a copy of it. You just have to click on File and then Save a Copy. I think that's what it's called. And that way you'll save a brand new copy in your own Google Drive, because we can't all be working in the same file. Okay, all right, so we can finally start doing something fun. So, how many of you have never worked in Google Sheets or Excel before? Raise your hand. All right, cool. So, the whole point of this is that you can use Google Sheets for basically the most basic data analysis. And this spreadsheet, all this data here, I got it from a public website from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. And what it is it's a spreadsheet of self-reported pollution emissions, air emissions, from thousands of point sources in the state. So these are big refineries and factories and petrochemical plants, and once a year they report how much they've emitted in terms of a few pollutants. So if you can scroll over to the right side of the sheet, you'll see that, you know, there's a column called COTPY. That means carbon monoxide tons per year. Right, and it'll give you the number of how much was emitted. And it has a few other chemicals like lead emissions, NOx emissions, particulate matter, etc. So just to start with the basics, what you're looking at is a Google Sheet, and you're looking at a single spreadsheet. If you look at the bottom here, you can click on, you don't have to do this, but there's another thing here called Sheet 1. So you can have multiple spreadsheets in a file, and this overall file is called, it's usually called a workbook, and within a book you can have multiple sheets. So right now we're in the sheet called State Sum. And then, you know, you can use your cursor to click on any one of these cells. So each of these is called a cell. And then if you go over to the left-hand side and just click on any of the numbers, it will highlight an entire row. So those are called rows. And then, you know, the A, B, C, D stuff, each of those is called a column. And rows and columns are going to be what you're working with in Google Sheets. So this very first row, that's number one, is called the header row. And that's the row that tells you what all of the data means, because you need to know what all the text means. So the header row, so if you look at A1, account is some designation of the account number of the company within the regulator's database. The next header row that says RN is also a sort of accounting index. We don't really have to worry about them. These are just used as bookkeeping for the TCEQ itself. The next column, company, just the name of the company. The one after that is site. A single company may have multiple sites that are reporting. So that's what that tells you. And then reporting year, for the entire spreadsheet, it's all 2015, because this is just 2015 data. And then county, we'll tell you the county the site is in. Region is another accounting thing that the agency uses. There's, I think, 16 geographic regions within Texas, so all of their regulations are set up for those 16 regions. SIC is just a code for the industry. So again, you don't have to worry about that. And then the description tells you, you know, what the site does. And then again, all of the columns from J through P are all names of the different compounds. So, you know, this is a pretty simple spreadsheet. There's not a lot of data on here. And what I've just told you in terms of describing what every column means and what the header row means, that information is usually contained in what's called a data dictionary or code sheet. And so whenever you get a spreadsheet with data, you want to get the accompanying data dictionary or code sheet, because without that, you won't actually understand what you're looking at. And so if you're ever FOIAing a database from an agency, you want to FOIA for not only the data itself, but also whatever data dictionary comes with it. So let's see. Before we do any sort of analysis, I want to talk a little bit about the different data formats that you can use in Google Sheets. So every cell is going to be coded as a certain format. So you can have something that's coded as a number, as a date, as a time, or as just general text. So for something like this, it's pretty obvious that company name and site name are all just text, right? And this is something that Google Sheets will automatically detect. So if you click on anything under the company column and just go, I think it's right click. Actually, I think you go to format. Right, so you click on a cell under company and go to format number, it'll say automatic. And that is because Google Sheets has automatically detected that it's text. And that's fine. You know, there's no problem there. The problem comes with, if you go to column G, which is region, Google Sheets is going to automatically code everything in this column as a number. But we don't want it to do that, because you are never going to do math on any of the content in that column, right? A region is just a code for a geographic part of Texas. So you're never going to be adding up the regions or anything like that, because that doesn't make sense. So you want Google Sheets to code that as text instead of a number. And the way to do that is click on the cell here that says G. Click on it once, so you've highlighted the entire column. And then go to format, number, and click on plain text. And this way you're forcing Google Sheets to read that column as text instead of numbers. And you'll never accidentally try to add them up or anything like that. And in fact, if you try to do math on it, I don't think it will let you. The other thing to keep in mind. Oh, SIC code is the same, right? They're codes for certain industries. You don't want Google Sheets to treat them as numbers. So click on the letter H. So you highlight the whole column, and again, go to Format, Number, Plain Text. Is everyone okay so far? It's sort of just common sense. Like, you kind of know, the only reason why this matters is you're gonna be choosing certain columns where you know the default is wrong, and you're changing it to something that's not the default, right? Like, when you look at this column and has numbers in it, so, I'm not sure right now what Google Sheets is coding it as, but it's probably automatically detecting it as numbers. So just to be safe, I'm forcing it to be read as text. And the other thing to keep in mind is if you ever get data with zip codes are always, you need to force it to be read as text. And that's because a lot of zip codes have a zero at the beginning, like for all the northeastern states, and if it's read as a number, it will just get rid of that zero, and you don't want it to do that. So zip codes are always coded as text, and I think that's it for this one. The SIC is some kind of industry code for every industry has a number. Okay, that's what it is. Great. So another thing is when you get a data set, you have to usually clean the data. Most data that you get, especially from the government, is going to be called dirty data because there will be typos and weird small errors that you want to check for. We don't have time in this session to really get into data cleaning, but there is a program called OpenRefine that it's free, it's open source, and there are all sorts of algorithms and stuff that you can use in it to clean your data sets. OpenRefine. You can Google for it. It's easy to find. And again, all of these things, you can Google for instructions on how to use OpenRefine. There's a lot of users online who, in forums and stuff will sort of describe how to use it. So for example, the easiest thing you do with data cleaning is to standardize spellings, right? So if you look at this right now, let's see, if you scroll down to, a lot of times what you'll have is two spellings of the same entity that are slightly different, right? So, something like, I'm trying to find a good example. I can't find one right now without sorting, but oftentimes if you have two companies, there's like right here, three entities, DCP, Midstream, LP, these three are all spelled correctly. But I know that later on in the spreadsheet, there's a couple entries that say DCP Midstream LP, and there are extra spaces between the words. And because of that, Google Sheets will read them as different companies. So if you're ever trying to do any sort of analysis for that company, Google Sheets won't recognize it as the same thing. Another common error is when you get, say you have a database of people's names, first name and last name. Some of those entries might come with a middle initial. Some of them might not. And that's another case where you may want to do some kind of data cleaning because you want to standardize all the spelling, make sure there's no typos, that sort of thing. Another standard check you want to do is make sure there aren't a lot of empty cells with no info. So this database is actually fairly clean. But sometimes you might get a database and you'll realize that there are hundreds of rows where there's just nothing in a cell, right? It's completely blank. Sometimes there's a good reason for that. Maybe the company didn't fill in that info and it's not important. But if you get a data set, let's say you got this data set for 2016, and for half of the data set, the company name was simply blank, then there's nothing you can do, right? You can go to the agency and say, do you have a more accurate, complete data set? And if they say, sorry, these companies just didn't tell us their names, then that data set is pretty useless, right? If you have a lot of missing info, a lot of info that you realize is a mistake, then that is data you cannot use. This data set is fairly clean, so we're okay, and we're going to be working with it today. So maybe the first thing I'll teach you is just some basic math. Let's say, if you scroll over to column J, let's say we wanted to add up all of to find the total tons of carbon monoxide that was emitted this year from all of these sites. What you would do is scroll to the very bottom. And you want to create a new row. So down here where it says add 1,000 more rows at bottom, we don't need 1,000. So just put your cursor there and type in 10. And then I think you can just press enter, and it will create 10 more rows. Okay. So once you do that, you want to tell Excel or Google Sheets to add up everything in this column. And you do that by typing in what's called a function. I'm going to type it in first, and then I'll explain what it means. So it's equals, open parentheses, J2, colon, J1940, close parentheses. And you can see it up here. If that's hard to read, I can type it on here so you can all read it. Equal sign. Close parentheses. So you want to type that here and then just click enter. That's what I forgot. J2-J1940. Equals sum. So that's what you're typing. This is the equation you want. And what it's telling you is the equal sign is what you type first anytime you're doing any kind of math. And then sum is the function of what you're actually doing. You want to be adding stuff up. And then you are putting parentheses around here because you're telling it what everything in the parentheses is what you're summing up. And J2 is the name of the first cell whose contents you want to add up. So if you scroll all the way up to the top, you'll see that J2 is the cell of the first number that you have for tons of carbon monoxide. And then colon J1940. J1940 is the very last carbon monoxide number that you're adding up. And the colon in between just means add up everything in between. All you had to do was type it in and then press enter. Is that what you did? Did everyone else get this number? 25033, whatever. Does anyone have questions about how this works in terms of adding stuff up and how you type it in? So you can, if you need to widen or narrow a column, just put your cursor in between, like on top of here, sort of on top of the line, and then you should be able to drag it, right? So if you do that to your own cell, you'll be able to see it. I think there is, but I actually like typing it out because then I know I'm not making a mistake or that I'm not, you know, not highlighting a couple cells or something. The beauty of doing it this way is if you don't want to add up everything in the column, let's say you just want to add up the first 50 numbers in this spreadsheet, you can just change this instead of 1940. You can just do J51, right? And then, or 52 or whatever, and then you'll only add up the first 50 or so rows. So if I click down here and Up here is what's called the formula bar. This is where you're typing in what you're telling it to do. So instead of J1940, I'll change it to J52, and then press return, and it gives me a much smaller number, right? It's only adding up those few cells. Another thing you can do, if let's say you just want to add up a few different specific cells, right? You're not adding up, say, everything between row 2 and row 50. Let's say you just want J2, J5, and J10. You can just type those in here with commas in between. I think that's how it works. J5, comma, J10. Let's try that. And that should work. So this is a way, if there are specific values you want to add up, you can just put commas in between.
I think that's very interesting about just sorting out these numbers the way that Lisa just showed to you, is that you can calculate the totals by region or by company. So you can use this just to compare how a company compares to another or a specific region. Maybe you already know that something's suspicious in one of the regions, and you want to just make sure that the numbers show that. So any way you can sort it out already shows you a comparison point. So you can use that and put different comparison points in your data sheet.
Okay, so the next thing I'm going to teach you to do is if you want to create a new column to do math, to do any sort of unit conversion. So right now, our column J is in tons per year, right? And let's say you wanted to know what every number meant in terms of pounds per year, because you want to use pounds as your unit in your reporting. I think the conversion is 2,000, right? 2,000 pounds per ton. So what you want to do is to create a new column where every cell in that column, you're just multiplying whatever is here by 2,000. And the way to do that is I would click on the J up here, so you've highlighted the whole column, and then right-click. No, wait. Why isn't it working? Hold on. Okay, instead of right-clicking, go to Insert, Column Right, and it should create a blank column to the right. Everyone got that? Once you have that, let's see, I'm going to scroll all the way up to the top again so you can see row 2. And in the cell K2, I'm going to type equals J2 asterisk 2000 and then hit enter. So the formula here is equals J2 asterisk 2000. And what that's telling you it is take whatever is in cell J2 and the asterisk sign, which is shift 8, is multiply, and you're going to multiply by 2000. And then that number will appear in K2. So this number is carbon monoxide in pounds per year. And now what you want to do is have Google Sheets do the same thing for every other row in column K. One quick way to do that, you can just click on K and copy paste, right? So let's say I just wanted to copy and paste a few rows. I could just click on this, edit, copy, and then highlight these rows, for example, edit, paste, and it will automatically do that. So each of these numbers is 2,000 multiplied by whatever is to the left. So click on K2, go to Edit, Copy. I'll do it again with you. So K2, Edit, Copy, And then let's say I only want to do this for the next three rows, right? So then I would highlight the next three rows and then go to edit paste. But what if I wanted to extend it all the way for the entire column? I could highlight the entire thing and keep scrolling down, but that's a lot of work. So what I'm going to do instead is go back to K2, and there's a little blue rectangle at the bottom right-hand corner. Put your cursor right on top of it until it becomes a plus sign, and then double-click once it's that plus sign, and it will propagate that equation all the way down to the bottom. So I'll do it again. You're going to click on K2. There's a little blue square at the bottom right-hand corner. Put your cursor on top of it until it looks like a square, looks like a cross, and then just double-click really quickly. Left-click, double-click, yeah. I think I might have accidentally done something. And one thing to keep in mind is when you do the double clicking, it will only propagate the equation down to the first empty cell. So if you have any empty, you know, blank cells in column J, basically, it's going to stop there. But this data space is actually pretty clean, so... If you go all the way down to the bottom, you'll see that it's done it all the way down. So we know there are no blanks anywhere in column J. I'm not sure, because if it's blank, there's nothing you can do to a blank cell, right? There's no operation you can do on it. What I would do is, I'm going to teach you sorting very soon. If you sort your stuff so all the blanks are at the top or at the bottom, then you don't have to deal with it. So let's see how to do that. Okay. These numbers down here, you don't really need them. They were just the totals you had calculated earlier. So I'm going to teach you next how to do sorting, and sorting is something that is always useful because it tells you the smallest or the largest of something. So, you know, let's say we wanted to find out which site that has reported pollution reported emitting the most amount of carbon monoxide, right? We want to know who's the worst player in Texas for carbon monoxide. And so the way to do that, actually, sorry, before we go on, you need to label the header row for column K. Right, we know what we did was carbon monoxide pounds per year, so I would probably just put CO, you know, pounds per year, something like that, just so you know what it's referring to. Yeah, you can write it however you want. So we're gonna sort by pounds per year because we want to find the worst offender for carbon monoxide emissions. So what you want to do is click on this little square up here that's right at the intersection, that's right at the left-hand corner, so that the whole sheet is highlighted. Yes, it's right below the thing that says FX. So you just click on that, and when you do that, it highlights all the contents of your entire sheet. And then what you want to do is go to Data and go all the way down to Sort Range. So it's the fifth selection there. Once you click Sort Range, a little box should pop up. Does everyone have that? Okay. And now you want to click on the little box here that says Data has header row. And what you're telling them is that your spreadsheet has a header row, and so it's able to recognize the header rows. Every database you ever work with should have a header row. If it doesn't, that's a problem. You always have to click that. And now you go to Sort By, and when you click on these little arrows, all of your column headers will suddenly show up, right? And what we want to do is we want to sort by, carbon monoxide pounds per year, because we want it to put in order from smallest to largest or largest to smallest, what entities are spewing out carbon monoxide. So you're going to click on CO pounds per year, or you can click on COTPY. Either one is fine. And then there are these things here that say A to Z versus Z to A. It's going to default to A to Z, which means the first row that's going to show up is the company that spewed out the least amount of carbon monoxide. As journalists, we're usually looking for the worst offenders, so we're not interested in who put out the least amount of carbon monoxide. We want to know who put out the most. So you're going to click on the little circle here that says Z to A, and that will tell it to put the worst offender at the top. And once you've done that, just click sort. And you'll see that, you know, both columns J and K, the largest numbers are at the top. And you'll be able to see that the worst offender was Luminant Generation Company, which is, I think, a big coal plant in Texas. Does that make sense? Like, do you see how something like this might be helpful to sort things, right? And you can resort by any other column that you want, right? So one thing you might want to do, let's just click this again, go to data, sort range. And again, data has header row. If you want to look at this in terms of alphabetizing the company name, you can do that too. If there's a particular company you're searching for or just want to see it arranged by company name, you can just say sort by company, and in this case A to Z is fine. I'm fine with the A companies at the top. Sort, and now it will put all the company, put the whole data in order with company name at the top. And now what you're actually seeing is how many repeat sites there are for every company, right? So you can see that Acme Brick Company shows up five times, because the same company owns, five different sites, and each of them has reported pollution. So this is kind of a way to maybe, you know, if you're looking for companies that have a lot of sites, this is one way to kind of look at that. You will see that, I think if you scroll down to DC Midstream, you're around like row 367, you'll see that DC Midstream LP shows up a million times. And if you scroll down to 389, you can see that there's different spellings of DCP Midstream, right? There's one with, looks like two spaces or three spaces between the first two words, and the next one has fewer spaces. This is one of those cases where data cleaning is needed, because if you're ever, Google Sheets will treat the different spellings as two different companies. And depending on what analysis you're doing, you don't want it to do that. You have to tell it what to do, and I don't have time to really get into it, but there are ways to, I think in OpenRefine, you can sort of tell it, okay, for DC Midstream, I want to standardize the spelling this way, and then it will correct all of them into that. Yeah, it's kind of like search and replace. Same idea. So let's see. I think we don't have too much time, so I'm going to teach you how to filter, because that is really fun. Let's say you were only interested in looking at the sites for DCP Midstream. So once again, so filtering means you only want to look at a subset of the data you have. And if you only wanted to look at the data for the company DCP Midstream, you would, again, click on this little rectangle under FX, and then go to data. Let's see. Wait, don't do what I'm doing. Data filter. And then Oh, I can just click here. That's easy. Right. So what you need to do is click on this, go to data, and then down here, your thing should either say filter or turn off filter. If it says filter, click on it. And what should happen is on your header row, there's this little like three line thing at the right hand of each header row. If you see that, then click on it for where it says company, right? Like, so right now this cell says company and there's a little symbol on the right hand side. That's the filter symbol. You want to click on that. If that symbol isn't showing up, then you need to turn it on by going to data, turn on filter or data filter. So once you click on this symbol, it will let you filter by company. And so the easiest way to do that is just to first hit clear, because right now every single company name is selected, which is why, you know, the entire spreadsheet is here. So you want to click on clear, and then I would just type in DCP midstream, and you'll see that three of them show up. So somehow, due to some typo error type thing, Google spreadsheet thinks there's three different companies called DCP midstream LP. And so you just want to click on all three of them. That way you get the whole set. And then when you click OK, you will have a smaller spreadsheet with just the entries for DCP midstream. Is anyone not there? So the question was, is there a way to just put the DCP stuff in a new sheet so that you can refer to it without having to undo it if you want to view the entire spreadsheet again? And the answer is yes. So I would just copy and paste what you found here into a new sheet. I think it's copy paste special, so just let me try that first. Make sure it works. So what you're going to do is you're going to click on that little rectangle again under the FX. Right. So again, right now, all you're seeing are the DCP entries. You can click on that, go to Edit, Copy. And then don't do what I'm doing right now. I'm just undoing what I just did. But once you've done Edit, Copy, click on the little thing at the bottom that says sheet one. You should all have it. And once you click on sheet one, it should be a completely empty new sheet. Click on cell A1 and then go to edit, paste special, paste values only. So that should work. Right, so now you have all the DCP stuff here. And then you can, if you go back to the bottom and click on state sum, you're back at the original. Now you can turn off the filter and get back the original complete data set. So the way to do that is, I would just click on this little box again under FX and go to that little filter symbol next to company. And then, let's see, I think it's clear and then select all. I would click clear first and then select all. And now every single company should be here. And then you can click on OK and you should have the original spreadsheet back. Right, all the companies are back. So if you're just doing paste, right, so that has to do with what formulas you have in the original. So remember when we created that new column for pounds per year of carbon monoxide? every number in that column was based on a formula, right? And you were saying J2 or something multiplied by 2,000. When you try to copy and paste that column into a new spreadsheet and just do paste, sometimes it's going to get confused because it's you're pasting like a formula that's from another sheet, and sometimes it won't find that reference. So if all you're interested in is the number itself, you may want to do paste special, paste values only. So it's only pasting the number, and it doesn't have to worry about referencing some formula that you wrote earlier. It can get pretty complicated. So in most cases, if you're copying and pasting something, you're only interested in the number or the words of that cell. You don't really care where it came from. So in that case, I would just do copy, paste special. It's always easier. So another thing I want to show you is you can create as many sheets as you want. So there's a little plus sign at the bottom there, and if you just click that, it will add a new sheet. And if you double-click on the text that says Sheet 2, you can rename it something, anything you want, so like new sheet. What is called Sheet 1 is what we used for the filtered DCP entries. So I might just double-click that and say DCP so that I know when I click on it, I'm only seeing the entries for that company. Let's see, we're a little over time.
You have 5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay, I'm gonna wrap up then by...
We need a few more minutes so we can take some of the last part too.
Sure.
Need to give them a break before the...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll just talk for a few more minutes. So, you know, I've obviously taught you just the very basics, but I'm hoping you can see how this kind of thing can be useful, right? That you can... The data sheet I got was just posted publicly on this agency, state agency website. And a lot of agencies will have databases online that you can just download and analyze and play with as you want. One really good place to find data sets is the EIA website. So just EIA.gov, you click around and there will be a ton of Excel spreadsheets that you can download. So you can just copy and paste them directly into a Google Drive, Google Sheet. Or you can download them into, you know, whatever form of Excel you have on your computer. And those EIA databases are usually pretty small and contained and easy to work with. So it's a good place to go to kind of just practice basic filtering and sorting. I'm going to talk a little bit about best practices. So one thing you should do if you're working with a data set that you're going to write a story about is keep what's called a data diary. And so everything that you're doing to the data set, you want to log it and write it down, right? So if you, you know, for something like today, I would say, you know, I created a new column called carbon monoxide pounds per year, and I did it by multiplying, you know, the other column, COTPY, by 2,000. So every time you change the data set you're working with, you want to write that down, because at some point, you want to be able to go back and recreate everything you've done to the database to double-check your work. If you're working in a newsroom where there's at least one other data reporter, it's always a good idea to have them check your work and redo the analysis just to bulletproof your numbers. Also, especially when you get into more complicated stuff, there are times where you may want to send your methodology to the company or the agency that you got the data from. Because you have nothing to hide, right? If you're analyzing data and it shows that, you know, this company spewed the most pollutant or this company had the most violations, you want to give the agency every opportunity to check your work, right? And if you've done your work correctly, there's nothing they can say. So if you give them all of your steps and methodology and they say, yeah, you're right, then you know you have a really good story. So there's nothing wrong with sending them your methodology. Another thing is, I would say it depends. I haven't actually worked on any stories where we've sent the methodology to a company, but I've done it with government agencies. Like, have you done it with companies before?
Yeah, we certainly shared. I'll talk about that in the next session. Okay. But it wasn't the kind of case where there was like a lot of steps to explain. It was more like, put together these two data sets, this is what we showed. I've actually gone back, you know, to all these companies and checked into the data sets, make sure nothing went awry. And so it was more like, if you screw up in reporting this to EPA somehow, it wasn't a complicated thing.
Right. I know that at ProPublica, I have a lot of colleagues who do really complicated methodology stuff, and what they'll do is when they publish the story, they will also publish a white paper that explains the methodology in great detail. And that way, it's giving people full transparency, and if you're a reporter or academic expert in the subject or, you know, someone who has stakes in this issue, you can read the methodology and try to poke holes in it if you want. I know we just did a big project on bankruptcy, and so the data reporter who worked on that wrote a 34-page white paper that is online and has all of the statistics, all of the databases they use, like step-by-step explaining everything so that there's full transparency. And, you know, for a project that big, it was vetted by multiple data reporters in the newsroom. They all double-checked and bulletproofed everything. And finally, the first thing that we did today, which was copy the data set into a brand new Google Drive file, you always want to do that. So every time you get a data set, you don't never want to work with the original copy. You want to make a copy and do all your analysis in that. Because at some point, you may want to go to the original and double check a number. You know, I've had cases where I've accidentally deleted a cell or accidentally deleted a number, and then later I'm thinking, did I delete it or was it always blank? Right? Then I can go back to the original file and double check. I think that's it. That's all we have time for. There's another Google document that I put up. So this is the URL. You can all just go to this URL on your own and read it. This was something I wrote up last year when I was still working at Inside Climate News. I had gone to a two-week data training program at ProPublica last summer, and during those 2 weeks, they sort of taught us the basics of data journalism and introduced us to all kinds of things. So when I, after that training, I went back to Inside Climate News and wrote a very basic memo about, you know, what is data reporting, why is it important, here are the different ways we can use it. And so it's very, very basic. And I think it might be useful just to think about why you as a freelancer or as someone in a small newsroom might want to take the time to learn this stuff, right? And it might also be helpful if you're trying to convey to an editor to give you the resources to go to trainings and stuff like that. I think that's it. So.
Thank you, Lisa. And just so add to the information that Lisa just said, I will collect information that she put together and that Jamie put together, and we'll put it on the SCJ website. So you'll have easy access to all that information, so you can replicate that and play with it a little bit more. We'll give about 5-10 minutes break before we start the next part of the session, so just make sure that everybody can get some coffee and try to shift a little bit from the Google Sheets to the next stage. So we are still in the same session within the workshop. It's just that we are going to move to Jamie's presentation. Okay? So let's say 10:25 here. Okay? Thank you.
You can actually get access to the Mac. I've used them both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've used it on my Mac.
But do you have like one of those double environments where I think you have a MacBook?
No, no.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone. We will start the second part of the session. And we have James Smith Hopkins from the Center for Public Integrity, who will talk to you about how you use data journalism, what kind of stories you can do, what type of stories you can do with data journalism. And for the record, just because we are recording this session, this is going to be a little more traditional than the first one, in the sense that if you have a question, we need to repeat the question to the microphone. So we will hold the questions until the end of the presentation. But this part, at least once we put in the website, is going to be a little more useful than the first part, at least the recording. Thank you.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay, great. I'm going to share three different projects that use data in different ways to just maybe spark some ideas about how you might use data in your stories or maybe techniques you can use. And actually, I do plan after each story to stop to see, do you have any specific questions related to that story or the data or specific problems or suggestions? But then we'll have a sort of a more general Q&A at the end, so I hope that's helpful. All right. Okay, so I highly recommend getting into a data state of mind, just like people talk about a public record state of mind, where you always want to think about what records might be out there to help me on the story. It's good to think about data in that way, too, that you know there may well be data that can help you. Maybe it's just a number, but maybe there's a data set that can help you with the story you're doing, or, in fact, maybe just playing around with the data set that could possibly be of on topic for you could help you find stories you might not otherwise have thought of. Sometimes there is no data set, and that's either the story, like how is it that there's no good data set of police-involved shootings, for instance, and so media organizations start trying to build their own. Sometimes it's not a story in and of itself, but you could create your own, or at least pieces of it, which can be a real public service. Okay, so the first example is one in which it's a project I worked on. Two of the examples I'm going to share are projects I worked on, not because I think they're fabulous, but because I can explain them well since I was involved in them. Another one is a Reuters project that I thought was great, and I happen to know one of the reporters, so I talked to him a little bit about it so I could share some lessons learned from that. But this is one where I started with two EPA data sets that didn't talk to each other, and I'll explain what I mean in a moment. All right, this is a story that we ended up calling America's Super Polluters. It used data sets to essentially answer the question, so how concentrated is air pollution? And this is specifically for stationary sites like manufacturing plants and power plants as opposed to, say, trucks and airplanes. But this is something the EPA tracks, and we wanted to answer the question, well, okay, there's a data set that tracks sort of air toxics, criteria pollutants. There's also a data set that tracks greenhouse gases. There's nothing that does both at the same time that we had found at least, and we wanted to put them together. And so I'm going to let my editor Jim explain to you in this video that the Weather Channel, a partner on this project, put together, explain to you the data aspect of the story. Hopefully, it will play. Can you hear that? No. Okay. Well, that's frustrating. We'll try moving the microphone, but we may have to give up on that. And I will explain to you instead of this. Try that again. No, it doesn't play. You can tell this is the first time I've used Google Slides. And I'm sorry that I can't play it for you. It's well worth watching because the Weather Channel did a really good job visualizing the data. And at heart, it was actually very simple what they did. They used a map to show first there's 100 sites, 100 sites that come on, 100 sites that have the highest level of releases in terms of sort of traditional air pollutants. And 100 sites that have the highest emissions of greenhouse gases, 21 of those are on both lists. And so they just sort of, they flashed 100 on a map of the U.S. and then another 100. They showed the 21 that were both. And they said, and four of those are in this little corner of Indiana, which really helps sort of explain how it was. It was basically the process we went through as we're going through the data of, like, once we got through the point of sort of bashing the two things together and making them play nicely with each other, trying to figure out, well, where's the story? I didn't start off this thinking, I'm going to do a story about Indiana coal plants. Not at all. In fact, I kind of had this sense, I don't want to write about coal plants. That seems like an old story. And, you know, there's so many other sources of pollution. But once I started looking at it, I realized I was wrong and I should reconsider. So that's kind of a strong example of how data can really help you figure out, well, what is the story and where should I tell it? Even if you're not thinking nationally, trying to figure out where should I tell the story in my readership area, my viewership area, can be really powerful. Oh, I see what the problem is. I'm no longer connected to the internet. That explains why. Yeah, it's yeah. Let me see if I can really quickly fix this. We've been having internet issues, but I've got a hotspot, so that should help. That's a little bit better. All right. Okay. So the basics of this data set are on the screen above. It's two data sets, both from the EPA. One's called the Toxics Release Inventory, or TRI to its friends. And then there's the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program. And there's a good bit of overlap in terms of the facilities on these lists that they don't all cover exactly the same thing. There's about 20,000 facilities, as I recall, that have to report to TRI. This is all self-reported, by the way. And roughly 8,000 sites that have to report to the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program. But in there, there's, you know, it's a Venn diagram, you know, you can see there's quite a bit of overlap. And so you can get a sense of, at least among facilities that have to report, which tend to be a little bit larger, not huge, you know, but a little bit larger, they have to have a minimum number of employees. For the TRI, they have to admit something that's on the required list, but it's a pretty large list. As I recall, it's over 200 different types of chemicals and metals. But anyway, so there's this overlap, we knew that there was the potential to put them together, but the problem is if you're matching data sets, you need something to match on, and usually that's a unique ID, some kind of identification number that the same ID number for facility and reporting to a program is the ID number they use reporting to this other program, but they don't. It's different IDs, different programs. This was not, as far as I can tell, some intention by EPA to make it harder to connect. It's just that's the way they did it. These are separate programs. They came up with their own IDs. So it would have made it extremely hard to try to figure out which facilities are the same. Even if they all use the same names in the two programs, which they did not, sometimes they were slightly different in a way that it wouldn't have been possible to link them up using a database manager like Access or SQL Server. In some cases, it was just sort of totally different for whatever reason. You know, one person in a company reported their facility to the program with one name, and another person at the company used another name. Maybe it was still reporting under the name of a company that used to own the facility. And anyway, names would never have worked. And so we needed numbers. We needed IDs to make this work. So I spent a lot of time asking, how can I do this? I was starting to dream about this. I swear to you, like, there must be some way using zip codes and something. Like, you know, I had latitude and longitude. Like, maybe I could use that. But again, it wouldn't necessarily be exactly the same. You know, it could be off just slightly. And we thought, like, could we use mapping? Anyway, so finally, I was able to get one of the PIOs at EPA to let me talk on background to somebody who was a data expert at the EPA who's very familiar with one program and sort of familiar with the other. Perfect. So I said, please, data expert, can you tell me? There must be an ID number I can use. And he said, oh, yeah, actually, we have this thing called the Facility Registration Service ID. That's just like a unique ID for facilities across programs. And I said, hallelujah, that's exactly what I was looking for. And so it was, it wasn't completely simple after that because one, you know, he needed to show me like where could I get it, where it's not just the number, but it's the facility number, this unique ID number, and all sorts of other program IDs, all these other programs that use their own ID for reasons that I cannot explain, so that I could say, aha, this ID equals this one in the TRI and equals this one in the greenhouse gas reporting program. As it happens, and I didn't even realize this when I was looking at the data sets because it was a sort of meaningless thing, this FRS ID number, it turned out that they actually had included it with the greenhouse gas reporting program data set. They hadn't with the TRI, and I think it occurred to them after talking to me, like, oh, maybe it would be a good thing to include, because when they released it the next year, they had it there too, which makes it easier for anybody else who wants to come later and connect the two to do that, because you don't have to go through several steps of trying to make it work. It's right there. So that was helpful. And I want to take a quick pause because it's easy for anybody working with data to get so caught up in the hard work of working with data to think, aha, I have the data, I've done the analysis, this is great, I'm going to write all about these numbers. And you have to remind yourself every single time, yeah, this seems fascinating to me because I spent a long time on it, but the story is not about data. It's about people. It's about using the data to find, either to find a story and to find people, or to help give a backbone to a story you're already working on. And so, actually, in many cases, the less data you put in the story, sometimes the better. And so it's really about trying to figure out what's most important, what do I need to explain to people? And I cannot say that I am great at that because I always want to stick everything in, and I have to, like, figure out what can I take out. I'm putting up this PS to say for myself as much as anybody else. So always trying to remember, how are people affected? Who are some of those people? If you happen to be working on a wildlife story, then maybe it's animals and people. But you always want to find some way to connect it back to people, because let's face it, we're self-centered people. We want to know why it affects people and why it might even affect us. So the lesson that I learned from the story, which I think is applicable to any data story, or really probably any story at all, is always ask, is there a way to do this thing I'm trying to do? And then keep asking it. Keep on asking. And if you can't get where you need to go with the agency you're working with, which may well have happened, asking people sort of outside who used to work there, or who academics who work with this data, or industry groups or environmental groups who might also use this data, could be helpful, because somebody else may have had the same problem and found a way to fix it. Another thing that was quite important, I think, in the story is figuring out when is the right time to share this information. Because what we were essentially doing was saying, well, these are the highest. We had a top 100 list. We also included a list of this, the 21 that were the highest for both traditional air pollutants and greenhouse gases. And so we didn't want to just wait to the last minute to say, hey, do you want to give us a comment? For the really highest, for the top 10, we went quite early and said, this is what we've done. It wasn't a really complicated methodology. That what was complicated about it was getting these two things together and then dealing with some issues that came up, like, you know, once, this is true of any data set, you know, once you get, you know, to the initial thing to work, then you start noticing things like, you know, this isn't actually the same facility, even though it uses the same number, because there's a contractor here on the same site of this massive manufacturing plant. And so you're dealing with these weird little things to get the data to be as clean as it can. So as a result, you know, you sort of assume there may be things popping up that we haven't even thought of. And so getting the agency whose data you're using, if you're using an agency's data, to take a look and to walk you through, like, does this analysis sound like a problem? Am I not thinking of anything? That was part of the value of talking to a data person, was I wasn't just asking him, how can I put these two things together? I was also saying, can you think of any caveats I should include? Are there any landmines I'm not thinking of? And so it was very helpful to have him say, yeah, you know, we've tried to do this too, and we kind of had a hard time with it, but it seems like a good thing to do, and, you know, I can't think of any reason why you shouldn't do it. That was very helpful. Yes? Sorry. Is that better? There we go. That's better. Sorry about that, guys. All right. Hopefully you could hear some of that before. Please let me know if you have any issues hearing or if I'm going too fast, which I do have a habit of doing. I get excited. Yes. Anyway, so talking to the keeper of the data is helpful, not only to sort of figure out, well, you know, I want to do this and there's some issue and I can't seem to figure out how to do it, but also, can you think of any reason I shouldn't do this? What are the caveats? Just because they tell you no, don't do it, doesn't mean necessarily you don't, because they might have a self-serving reason for saying that. But having that conversation, sort of walking through, well, okay, why not? Or if that's a problem, what about this way? Can you think of a way to do it? Have you ever done this yourself? That can be hugely valuable. Going to, if you're writing about institutions or companies, and it's going to show them in a bad light in particular, it's often helpful to think, how soon do I want to go to them? In this case, they weren't going to be able to argue themselves off the list unless they realized, oh, crap, we misreported to the EPA, which actually happened in one case. It was a small company. They happened to be reporting something that was actually more complicated than the typical thing that gets reported to the EPA, where they put in a number and then the EPA has to do the math. And so they put in the wrong version of what they were putting out. And so they didn't even notice that it ended up with, you know, huge, you know, tons and tons of a certain type of pollutant. It was only by checking with them that they realized, uh-oh. So they went back to the EPA. They got it. If they hadn't been able to get it updated, we probably would have had to include them with an asterisk. But they were able to update it in time that we didn't include them on the list. So just sort of that going and saying, this looks kind of strange. Are you sure you did that right? Was helpful. And certainly I'm sure they appreciated realizing there was a mistake. But for every other situation, the companies, to the extent that they engaged, many of them did, some just didn't get back to us, but most of them went and checked and said, yeah, that's what we reported. There are no issues, that's what we reported. And so that made us feel better. That was an external double check to make sure something weird hadn't gone wrong. We did, you know, some double checking back to the original data sets to make sure that the connection hadn't been fluey. That would have been an issue if there were ID problems or typos or things like that, you know, where manufacturing facility A in the state is getting connected with power plant B in this other state. But we didn't run into anything like that. And we did check with all the 100 companies on one list and all the 100 on another, which is, except for the 21 overlap, they were all unique. So that was a lot. But it was worthwhile. And we also asked them, is there anything you'd like to say, any context you'd like to include? And for all of those who gave some, we included it in our interactive. It was a great interactive. I encourage you to see. If you go to superpolluters.com, you can see it. And it allows you to not only sort of visualize how much stuff is this, but then you can see, did the company say anything about it? So that was a way to build in comments that we otherwise couldn't never have put in the story. There would have been so many. Our story is more focused on that. The other thing that was really driven home by the story is how useful it can be for newsrooms to partner with other newsrooms, which is something that a lot of the newer nonprofit newsrooms, I think, just do as a matter of course. But I had never done that before I got to the Center for Public Integrity, because I was a traditional newspaper and we didn't seem to do it. It's actually really helpful, partly because sometimes it's just a force multiplier. You can get your story in more places, more chances for people to see it. Sometimes it's, you know, I'll write a print story and you'll do a radio report, or the Weather Channel, in this case, did an 11-minute documentary, you know, a really good video. We just wouldn't have the ability to do that. So you can amplify your work, you can share resources. It ends up being really helpful. I mean, certainly partnerships can sometimes be time-consuming, and sometimes they're even frustrating, but usually they end up being well worth the time you put into them. Whether you're a freelancer or a person in a smaller newsroom or maybe in a bigger newsroom, you might find a story you feel like, boy, it'd be really helpful if we could work with this other reporter I know from this other newsroom. You might make the case to your editor, even if the newsroom has never tried it, to do that. We partnered with two newsrooms on this project, and the other one was USA Today Network. And so they ran our story, but they also pushed the data set early, you know, a couple of months early, to all of their, you know, more than 100 newsrooms. And so other places, in some cases, did their own stories with the data, which is really interesting to see, because I ended up focusing mostly on this part of Indiana, but there was a national data set. There were many other things that people could write about, and so some of these other newsrooms ran with it, which was pretty cool. This is an example of, unfortunately I couldn't play the video for you, but this is an example of something that my newsroom just wouldn't have been able to do, just because it's a traditional graphic that required a graphic designer. And we have some great data viz people, but this is just not the kind of thing that they do. And so sometimes just something as simple as, could you do the graphics for me, can be something you can get out of partnership. So I'm sorry I couldn't play the video so you could have a little bit more better sense of what the story was about. But before I move on to story number two, do you have any questions that about the data sets or about the idea of putting data together? Anything that you'd like to touch on before we move on? Yep.
Just 1 second. Sorry. Can you identify yourself and repeat the question, please?
Right. Yeah, so you're... Gotcha. Okay. So your question was, how do you use the sprawling toxics release inventory data set, in a way that you can get your arms around it and not blow up your computer? Yeah. So in this case, because I needed to connect two different data sets, I needed some sort of database program. And I used Microsoft Access, which makes me feel like a dinosaur. I think a lot of people who are doing database work now are using something like SQL Server or MySQL. But really, in the end, the idea is pretty much the same. It's just that Microsoft Access allows you to, if you feel like, I don't really know SQL at all, which is a database sort of light. I would call it like a light programming language. It's not as hard as trying to learn something like Python. But if you think I sort of know, but not very well, and I'm afraid I'm going to screw up, or I don't know it at all. The advantage of Access is it allows you to just have like a drag and drop interface and play around with that way. And then you can always hit a button and see what's the language behind it. It can kind of help you learn that too. But anyway, so but that was only because I was trying to connect two data sets. If I just wanted to use a TRI, you can use it in Excel. The challenging thing about it, and the reason why even with that, it can be more helpful to use a database manager is because what they're giving you is this huge data set that, for one thing, it's 20,000 facilities, give or take, but it's not just like, here's the grand total of all pollutants they released. It's a line for every single thing they release, which is actually very helpful because you would like to know what it is. I mean, is there lead? Is there mercury? What did they put out? You need that information, but it also means that if you're trying to make sense of it, like, tell me all the facilities that are putting out lead and how much or something like that, you need to do something with it beyond just very simple Excel stuff. One thing you can do is use a pivot table, which I know that you were talking to Lisa about that. Pivot tables are something you can do in Excel, and it sort of allows you to get some of the power of a database manager without having to go to another program. And so I highly recommend that if this is something that interests you and you haven't had a chance to use them, to try it out. I swear that I spent a lot of time on database managers before I ever played around with pivot tables because I'm like, what do I need that for? I'm using Access. And then I use them, and I'm like, this is great. It's so easy. For certain things, you don't even need to pop over. You can just do it as a pivot table. It's helpful. There are tip sheets out there about how to use it. In fact, if you just Google how to use a pivot table, you can probably find good introduction online. But you can also find journalists who'd be happy to help you with it. So that's one thing you can do. You can find out, just give me the grand total of everything for all facilities, or just give me the things in my state, or just give me the things in my state that are putting out lead. It might be easier to get your arms around that way. But the good thing is that, even just, sort of an oldish computer can handle should be able to handle the TRI data set. It might be a little slow, but you can do it. Any other questions on this one? Okay. All right. So now one of the questions I got asked when we were having a really nice brainstorming session was, okay, but what if there's no data? Which is a great question because that comes up. And it's very frustrating, but sometimes you end up, when you go down that road, you end up with a far better story because you're going to put together your own data set. You'll have something nobody else has. You'll be telling government agencies something they don't know in some cases. Sometimes that's a really good thing to pursue. So what I see as one of the best recent examples of this is Reuters' lead investigation, Unsafe at Any Level. And what they wanted to answer really was this question of, well, so how do other places compare to Flint? Because everybody now understands that Flint had and has serious lead problems. They wanted to know what were other places finding. And they were running into the problem that there wasn't good localized data. It's a sad picture of a little kid in a place with peeling paint. So national, state, and county data on lead levels in blood tests is not totally useless, but it's not really very useful in the end. Because what really matters is where are the local hotspots, not where's the average issue in a county. You could have a situation where a county on average looks all right because most places are fine, and then one town is, or maybe even a couple of blocks are just, off the charts, the worst in the country, and you would never know because it's being obscured by the summary data. And so what you want is local data. You want as local as you can get, which often ends up when data reports are trying to get local data, usually it's maybe the census tract or the zip code. Sometimes you can get even more local data, but when you're talking about things that can be personally identifying, that's usually about as low as you can get. So the problem that Reuters ran into is that there is no national data set with this kind of data. So they did it themselves. They called state after state after state, and they asked for those figures, they got, exactly the problems that you would expect, which is some states said sure, and others said absolutely not, and some said, well, we have it, but we're not sure we can get it to you, and some states had said sure, took a long time. It's pretty much what you would expect, but they just were persistent. And so they ended up with a story that had data from 21 states, which is really good. One of the reporters told me that there was, some thought of, well, maybe we should keep pushing through till we get all of them or even more. And a smart editor encouraged them, no, once you get up to sort of a good number, go with it. You'll be able to tell people something, and you also, by dint of the story and pointing out in a map who did not give you data, you have some pressure points that can get you data from other states. And it actually, as I understand it, worked. They did later get more states. They started off with 21 states. This is how they handled the problem of these gaps they had, which I thought was a good explanation. Put it into context what they had and what they didn't and why. And also explain that 21 states, which is less than half, but it's more than half the population, which was smart. And what they found is nearly 3,000 areas with rates at least double those in Flint at the peak of the crisis. And more than 1,000 of those communities had, even much higher rates of elevated blood tests. So this is something that, I've not seen that report anywhere else. There's been a lot of lead reporting, and so if you see it somewhere else, I just missed it. But I was really impressed with this because this was a case of, it would have been a public service to take a data set people weren't paying attention to and telling them about it, but it's even more of a public service to have to create it. So the lessons they learned from that is, and this is applicable to a lot of other things, not just lead, is localized data can tell you local and national stories, but national level data cannot tell you local stories. You need this detailed data to be able to do both. And so that's always what you want to try to get. If you're looking for data really on anything, it doesn't have to be an environmental or environmental health topic, you want the raw data, you don't want the summary tables. And if there are summary tables that some agency has put together, they've got data, there's some more raw data, and that's what you want to ask for. Another lesson is get what you can and start publishing. You can make that decision. There might be a good decision to wait till you have more, but sometimes starting when you feel like I've really got a good amount, it's just not all I want, can be powerful. And then this is the lesson for every single story, but especially stories about data. Don't don't treat data any differently than a person because it's made by people and they're fallible. There can be mistakes in there because of data entry error. There can be mistakes in the sense that the problem isn't the data set, but the problem is you think you can interpret a certain way and actually for some reason the way the data was collected, you can't. So the way Mike Pell, one of the writers, put it is, assume it's laden with caveats and sometimes even errors. And so you just have to ask a lot of questions and sort of poke it for problems and ask the people who put it together and ask the academics who study it, what am I not thinking of? What are the limitations? Even with that, they ran into a problem I think it was LA. It was a place in California. Gave them data. They found surprisingly high levels in a wealthy area. And so they asked a lot of questions, what's going on here? Are you sure about the data? And they were told, oh yeah, there's old housing stock. And so they published a story and then it came out, no, actually the data was crappy. There was a problem with it. It wasn't reflective of reality. And there was an initial Reuters really screwed up response by the public officials. And Reuters, because they had done their due diligence, could show, no, actually, these are all the things that we did to validate the data with you guys. This is your problem. Still wasn't a fun thing for them to experience, but it meant that they, by doing their due diligence, it helped them after the fact. And then they wrote about those issues too. And I think that's a good way of handling it when something comes up is you just keep writing about it. Any questions about that? Yep. I know. Yeah, that's a good question. The question is, what did states say when they argued that patient confidentiality prevented them from sharing zip code and census tract data, which is a fabulous question, and it comes up all the time with anything that possibly gets into health because of health privacy laws, and usually the answer is they're misunderstanding or purposely misinterpreting the law. The fact that their efforts to get past that argument didn't always work meant that sometimes, you try to get the information and they literally just will not give it to you. So sometimes bringing a lawyer in to say this is the law and also this is the public information law and you have to give it to us, sometimes that can help. But that's a great question and it comes up way too much. It's sort of like classification, right? This is classified, you can't get this document. It happens too often. Any other questions? Okay. Third story is another one that I worked on. It gets to the issue of thinking about data beyond just something that's, clearly on your beat. In this case, trying to figure out how you can get non-environmental data to help you tell an environmental story. So in this case, how the Department of Education and the Department of Transportation can tell you something about air pollution. And this is another case of having to put two data sets together. And this is one where I could not have done it on my own and needed help because it involved complicated mapping. And so I lucked out that I had someone in the newsroom who could help me with this. But if that had not been the case, I would have looked for a partner who could have, which is a way to get around, problems sometimes. So this is a case of the problem of air pollution around roads. Cars and trucks create air pollution. We often don't think about it, or maybe we'll think about greenhouse gases, but we don't think about the way it can affect lungs and heart, and now studies are suggesting brains as well. But the main issue is fairly close to roads, and the busier the road, the more concentrated air pollution can be. And so we really wanted to answer the question of how many schools are close to busy roads. So it required mapping to figure out how that was, figure out the answer to the question. And this is not something I can't claim this is a unique idea because there have been really good local and regional and sometimes state level stories done about this issue, but nobody could find had done this nationally. And we discovered the reason why when we tried to do it, which is that it is really annoying. it's frustrating because all data has some issue with it. And one of the issues is that Department of Education data, I'll go here so you can see exactly where it comes from. It's kept by the National Center for Education Statistics. So they ask all the schools to report into the states, all the school districts, which then report to the center. And there's rules about how the school is supposed to report. They're supposed to report the mailing address and the physical address of all their individual schools and a bunch of other information. But sometimes the schools will give the wrong address for their physical address. You know, maybe they'll give their district headquarters for their address. Maybe they're an online school and they didn't check the box that says online school. And so you think they're physically located somewhere. And so as a result, we spend a lot of time, and I say we, this is another case of, you know, if you need some help, sometimes going outside the newsroom can be helpful. We partnered with Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting, which is a great investigative radio program. And they've got fabulous data reporters. And so we worked together to try to figure out how can we knock out or fix the location of schools that are put in wrong in some way. And so we were trying to go through to figure out all the ways in which things could be wrong, partly by talking to other people who are familiar with the data set and partly by just playing around with it and figuring out, you know, like, huh, that school seems odd. Wait, there's 12 schools in one location? That can't be right. And working with it. Before I get on, move on to that, the key finding in this case was nearly 8,000 U.S. public schools within 500 feet of highways or other busy roads, which meant that there was air pollution risk. And a lot of this will depend on issues of which way does the wind tend to blow? Is it blowing from the road to the school? Or sometimes it's more often going the other way. And so, so people's, experiences in the school could vary, but it's not a good location. It's one that EPA started warning against, but it just, the message really hasn't filtered down to schools, and school districts and people who are actually building or renovating schools. And so, you know, new schools keep getting built in these areas. So, the lessons in this case, which again, I think probably end up applying to a lot of other kinds of stories, is that if it's complicated, you're probably going to want to talk to a lot of experts about your analysis before you get far into it. And that could be, you know this data, which I know about it, but it could also be, I'm trying to do this thing which involves, you know, something that's a little bit, sadly, slightly fuzzy or subjective, which is exactly, because air pollution, It's usually not just like, you know, here's the line. On this side, it's dangerous, and on this side, it's safe. You know, it sort of goes down like that. And so trying to figure out what area should we be looking at, how close to the road should this be, and I talked to more than a dozen academics, and some of them said, well, you know, you could use this figure, you could use that one, you could look at these studies, and very few wanted to say, this is the number you should use. And so I just talked to a lot of people and said, if we did this, does this seem reasonable? You know, we don't want to pull in way too many schools. We don't want to, you know, set it so far away from the roads, you know, that we're needlessly scaring people. But we also don't want to cut it off so soon that we're making people think, oh, you know, I'm 300 feet away from the road, so I'm okay, you know, if that's not necessarily the case. So talking this through with people, and, you know, if somebody can't just say this is the answer because it's complicated, talking through what are the caveats I have to keep in mind? How, you know, if I did it this way, would that be okay? Or maybe a couple of different ways, how can we approach it, can be helpful, even though it's frustrating as you're going through it. And so you're basically trying to find pitfalls, defining parameters, in some cases saying, am I using the best data? You know, this is why having the conversations early can help, because you might realize, oh, there's this way more helpful data set I should be using instead. So we ended up having to define busy road two ways, because it's nothing as simple. And what we, based on studies and experts we talked to, what we realized is, well, just number of vehicles is an issue. You know, so if you're near, like one school was, near a 12-lane highway in California that's very busy and sometimes congested, yeah, that's obviously one that you'd want to catch. But also, you could be near a school like this here, two lanes, and might think, oh, okay, well, that's fine, right? But the problem is they get a fair amount of truck traffic and old truck traffic. Diesel, particularly older diesel trucks, are more of an air pollution problem. And so we wanted to take that into account in some way. And so what we ended up deciding is the road has at least 30,000 vehicles of any type, we're going to include it. And that was based on ended up being based on mainly on studies, you know, that there have been a lot of measurement studies, but also by running this past experts who do this work to say, does that sound okay? And nobody said, oh, no, it should be much higher. It's interesting because California, which actually has a law about this, it's not entirely well enforced, but they have a law because they're trying to keep new schools from getting sited too close to roads, use a much higher figure. I forget now if it's 50,000 or 100,000. And that's not – a good thing to remember is policy isn't necessarily always set based on health. It may have been at the time. Maybe it's old. Maybe there's new data. Or it may be sort of an acknowledgement that this is the best we can do because we've got reality to deal with and we have a lot of roads and not a lot of land. And so if you're trying to get a better sense of what is actually good to consider, maybe existing policies are a starting point, but you could also just go to the research and see. So our second test was, does the road have at least 10,000 vehicles a day, but at least 500 of them are trucks? And so this school here in Newark was an example of that. They're also right by an intersection, and stop-and-go traffic is worse than traffic just moving along on a road. And that's just because, you know, having to start up again, you're putting out more pollution. So having that discussion with scientists was helpful, but also discussing it with locals that were dealing with pollution problems helped me get my mind around this, because I had heard a lot about this community. This is a neighborhood called the Ironbound in Newark. And they're right next to one of the biggest ports in the country. And so they get a lot of port truck traffic through the neighborhood. And they have been wrangling with this for years, trying to convince the port to require better, basically newer trucks, which had better control technology on them, to require that trucks coming to the port be newer. Which is a very difficult topic because these trucks don't belong to the port. So I knew from talking to this community that was dealing with this issue what they were seeing, and I had the sense that, you know, any kind of parameter I come up with that doesn't include neighborhoods like this, even if somehow maybe this neighborhood shouldn't be included, but if it wasn't including neighborhoods that got at this issue with a lot of truck traffic but not necessarily highway level traffic, was going to be problematic. And so that was a helpful gut check as I was talking to experts. So probably the running theme through this has been, you know, you can't do it all yourself. Or maybe you can, but it can be helpful to work with others because you're only one person. You've got a lot to do. Working with people who can help you do more or can bring skill sets you don't have can get you better stories or can help you tell the story visually in a way that maybe you couldn't. And so I'm so happy that my newsroom has Chris Zdeckskis, who he's now a data editor, but at the time he was a news developer working on visualizations. In fact, this one right here, this is an interactive, so you can't really appreciate it unless you see it online. But he went above and beyond in the story because I just didn't have the mapping chops to be able to do this, what seemed to me pretty complicated exercise of figuring out, you know, exactly how close these things are to the busiest road near them. It's not just how close are they to the closest road. It's how close, you know, are they within 500 feet of what we've defined as a busy road. So that was way beyond me. I'm sorry he wouldn't let me give him a byline. He's too modest because the story was impossible without him. And if you don't have somebody like that in your newsroom, you may be able to find somebody like that somewhere else. So don't give up if you can't do it. Also, there's a thing I discovered about data journalists is they're really awesome people who are perfectly willing to help you with your stuff, even if, yeah, they'll never get credited for it. So it's a good idea to find somebody who can help you do stuff if you really want to try it all by yourself. And getting on listservs like the IRE NICAR listserv that where data journalists gather is one way to say, help, I can't do this, what do I do? And people will help you. So what this interactive allowed you to do is put in any address, not just a school, and find out, is it near a road that's defined in this way? This just happens to be one where there's so many roads, it's just this massive red. But the idea is that you can see, visually see, like, okay, what is 500 feet away from the road? It was pretty cool. And by teaming up with Reveal in this case, we got, you know, really helpful data help from, you know, in the process of figuring out how do we toss out schools that just shouldn't be there? How do we fix their address if they're not where they should be? And doing it in such a way that, because there was like more than 100,000 schools, you could never do that one by one. It's using programming to sort of figure out where are the things that look like outliers and are they okay to keep. Reveal also did a regression analysis that allowed us to make sure we were using our language correctly, dealing with the issue of, you know, how race and income was affecting location near busy schools. Because, I mean, just looking at the numbers, you're like, whoa, there's definitely a problem here. You know, it affects people from all backgrounds, but it definitely is affecting people, schools that have higher shares of low and no and reduced priced lunch eligibility, and also schools with higher percentages of non-white students more. And the regression analysis that Eric at Reveal did showed that it was more complicated than that. It was a lot to do about do you live in an urban area or a suburban area or a rural area? And there's like a long, you know, history in America about why people live where they live. So race was definitely a factor. It just wasn't quite as direct as I was thinking looking at it. Just it meant a tweak of the language, that was all, and talking about some of this history. But without that analysis, you know, I probably would have made a jump that wasn't quite right. Real also then did a great hour-long radio episode about this issue and bringing in some issues of people trying to do their own air testing. So that was really cool. All right. So that gets us through all three examples. I'm sorry to shoot past 11. What questions do you guys have or thoughts or brainstorming do you want to do? Yes.
Sorry, just for the record, can you identify yourself and we will repeat the question.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a good question. So the question is, if you're working with a data set, what about going back to that same data set because things change? You know, it's and we're used to doing a story and then like that's it. But just like you know, something at City Hall might develop over time and we want to follow that, what about going back to data and seeing how things change over time? And yeah, in some cases I have done that. In the case of the super polluters, you know, the connection of the two pollution data sets, the EPA, we did go back. I guess it was this year. It feels like such a long time ago. We went back and used the updated data to do it again. And the way we ended up doing it was, in the original story, we really ended up focusing on this region and all of these plants there and backstory and what did that mean for people and talking about health and research and things like that. The second story, we ended up just focusing. It was much more simple. We focused on the largest greenhouse gas emitter, which didn't even require connecting the two data sets. We did connect them, but it just in the end it didn't, just because it was sort of interesting in its own right. And so we did a story about that, but it did mean that it was an excuse to put up the new data set, you know, with new data that people could look at and compare, contrast over time, see, you know, had things changed. The trends were actually very much the same, even though in general the trend, particularly for the toxics release inventory, has been downward, which has been good. In fact, there's been, I believe there's actually been some research to the effect that simply measuring and making the information public causes a downward trend over time, because the one is sometimes the companies are just on notice, like people are looking, so we better think about this. But sometimes it's just as simple as like, oh, we never thought to measure before because we didn't have to, and so now maybe we should figure out how we work with this. And sometimes it's not even the public aspect of it that, you know, it's not the shame aspect necessarily. Sometimes it's just the measuring, like what gets measured. If something isn't measured, you don't know it's a problem, so you don't even think to fix it, kind of thing. So it's not surprising that over time this has gone down. Regulations have also played a role, and in some cases closures can play a role too if you're just looking at like overall averages for an area. So what I found is that in general numbers were down somewhat. Some places actually went up though, but the trends of who were the biggest in what states, that sort of stayed very similar, which was interesting. I just ended up not really getting into that aspect of it because of how we chose to do that story to make it not feel like it was kind of the same thing. But the data set was there. And that's a good question to ask yourself is, if you're doing something with data, is this something you might want to come back to every year or maybe more frequently or less frequently, depending on the story, because it might be a public service to readers? Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. The question is, what was my rationale wanting to combine the sort of things that are measured by TRI, like, you know, lead and mercury and things like that? I keep saying criteria pollutants, but actually some of the TRI doesn't measure literally everything, and so... I think it may include some, but not all of the ozone precursors, and so it doesn't include some of that stuff, which is also interesting, which gets measured in other ways. And I just couldn't bear to think of trying to pull even more data sets in. So since that covers a lot of things, I stuck with that. But the reason I decided to link the toxics release inventory with greenhouse gas data is because although the TRI also looks at water and land sort of storage of pollution, I thought I'm going to focus on air. And I'm going to see where these things intersect because, in part because people tend to think, and I feel kind of bad, I don't even know if I really sort of just said this in the story, but people tend to think of greenhouse gases as a problem that's sort of unconnected with other things. But if you look at facilities, you know, there's a number of facilities where it's actually sort of intertwined with this other problem that's more immediate health problem. Sometimes like very immediate, like it can cause an asthma attack, but sometimes it's more of a long-term health problem like heart disease. And so I thought it'd be interesting to get into this issue of how sort of this big global problem that doesn't seem at all local intersects with things that really are very local. That was the idea. That's one way of thinking of it. Yeah, that there are co-benefits to doing that. But it was the interesting thing was more how are these things connected, which means that as regulators, policymakers try to figure out, you know, what to do, you know, that you can't really, they're not really separate. You're thinking, and co-benefits actually is a good way of pointing it out, that they're, you do one thing and you have ripple effects. But it's not only sometimes not understood, but also I think is sometimes purposely, talked about as if who cares about co-benefits, because that's not what we're trying to do. But they're often intertwined. Depends on the facility, but they often are. That's true of vehicles, too. Thank you. Good question. Other questions or thoughts? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Uh-oh. Do you want to switch seats?
Hi, I'm Bernardo Mota from the University of Florida, St. Petersburg, and what I'm going to show to you today is a very quick, very simple, but sometimes people don't think about them too much. The idea is many times when you're a freelancer and you're all on your own trying to do all this stuff, or if you're working in a small newsroom and you don't have a lot of help, and you start thinking, how can you make a presentation of your work to look a little more professional without spending way too much time or even too much money into that presentation? How can you compare your work with big newsrooms in a way that you can say, well, at least it looks professional so I can sell it. I can make some money out of it without putting too much money into it or too much time. because if you think about all these designs, all these data visualization, they're either very expensive or they take a lot of time for you to do. And the idea that Lizzie and I were trying to discuss this was mostly based on how can we make your life easier? How can we make things simpler? And think about data in general, but think about journalism in general. A few things that Jamie and Liz already talked about, but I want to repeat here, is that one, even if you're alone, you're not alone. You have resources. You have a lot of things that can help you. One, you're here, SCJ. So you already have a group of people who are willing to help you. So contact people in this organization and they will help. I've tried many times, have never failed to get some help from people who are here in this organization. Another thing is, probably wherever you are in the United States or even outside of the United States, there might be a university right next to you, sometimes even a small college. And they are always looking for really cool projects for their students to do or for themselves to do, for the faculty to do. And they are willing to help, sometimes even for free. They're just going to take their time and talk to you about your projects. It doesn't have to be the journalism schools sometimes. We work a lot with our business schools because they do a lot of data-driven work. So you can actually talk to people there that might help you get the information you need or to think about your data in a different way. And more than anything, if you look to the right people, sometimes even among yourselves, just because you're a freelancer, you're trying to make money, doesn't mean that you can't work for another freelancer who's also trying to make money. Sometimes together, you make more money. So you start thinking that collaboration might be a good way for you to get things done. So you can accomplish more in a short period of time. But these tools here, they are not reinventing the wheel in any way. They are not my ideas. I didn't create any of them. They are out there. They're easy to find. They're easy to use. And most of them are either free or very, very cheap. I use some of them with my students because I work for the neighborhood with the Neighborhood News Bureau, which is an embedded newsroom that we have that the University of Florida, St. Petersburg has in a specific part of the town that's called Midtown. And it's a historical African-American neighborhood. And we have no budget. And my students, usually they come to me in all different types of knowledge. Some of them are really good with data. Some of them have never seen a data set before. Some of them are really good photographers. Some of them have never taken a picture before. So I have to work with them, and I have to work with them with tools that they can learn really, really fast, because I can't spend the whole semester teaching them how to use the tools, and then they don't have time to report. So these are tools that I can teach my students in about 2 to 5 minutes, which means you can learn probably even faster than that. Sometimes of them, you just open them and they're already ready to use. One of them that's really cool, and I already have them open here because I saw that we can't play the videos because of the sound, but that's okay. I think actually I missed the first one, but let me see if I can open it here. It's called Verse.com. And this was, actually I learned about this through Ren LaForme, who is a journalist with the Poynter Institute, and he's a specialist in digital tools. So that's what he does. So if you want to find more tools, he's always updating his column about digital tools. That might be something useful for you. But this Verse.com, what it does is, if you're working with video, and maybe you don't think you are a really good videographer, or you are a good videographer, but you want to find a way to stand out. You want to find something that will make your video look really, really cool. What this does is, Verse creates an interactive part for your video. So it actually read your video, you upload your video, and you can separate in pieces that will be interactive, where you can click on things. And it has a free account, so if you're just using this very sparingly sometimes, you can get a free account, it might be enough for you. In my case, what I did, I called them, and because we couldn't afford the business part that they have, the account here they have, I asked them about educational discount, and they created a student account just for us. Now it's actually on the website, so you can actually click there and you can find the student version of that because of it. And what it does, it creates a bunch of different options for you to see. As you can see there, hotspots, for example, you're playing your video, and in one point, you want something to show. For example, it could be a link to a website that people can click on. It can be another video that you want to show on that part of the video just for to introduce, or it could be a page that you have a slide or something like that. So it could be the slideshow. So each one of the hotspots, you can include a specific feature. So it could be a slideshow. It could be a Q&A. This Q&A is really interesting because sometimes you record a bunch of interviews with experts trying to explain what your story is. Especially if you talk about data journalism, you need explanation. You need someone to make things easier for people to understand. So the Q&A, what it does is you can write the questions, and then people can click on the questions they have, and it goes directly to the answer in the video. So if you already find the answer you're looking for, sometimes you have a one-hour video, people sometimes they don't have time to watch the whole thing. Or even in a five-minute video, you can actually separate in Q&A too. Another thing that we found out worked really well, both the Q&A and the Pathfinder. Pathfinder is when you can choose where you go next in the video. So you can choose the order by which you are watching the video. And sometimes you have five or six, for example, talk about data. You have all this data set. Let's talk about QRI and pollution. And maybe even talk about the school situation. You have all these schools. And of course, you don't have time to report on all of them, but you could report on six of them, maybe five or four of them, and get those stories. And then you can put them right there in the Pathfinder. So the people, while they are watching the video, they can hit the hotspot and click on the Pathfinder, and then you have all four schools. And then you click on one of the schools, and you get the story that you did with that school very specifically. So you can get a personal story. And chapters. Again, people don't have time to watch the whole thing. They might want to watch one chapter, or maybe they want to go back to the video, but they don't want to be looking for that particular part. So the chapter already put you in that particular place where you want to be. So basically what it does is it creates kind of a DVD feature, but on online videos. And it's perfectly embeddable, very, very easy to use. Once you start there, all you have to do is upload your video, and then it already separates in hotspots where you can split and choose which one you want to use and add these features. So for me, that's one of the most useful and interesting ones because, well, it looks good. It looks professional. Of course, it depends a little bit on your quality of videography, but you don't have to be great. I have students who have never picked up a camera before, and they can use it. The second one that I want to show to you, and this actually is not just one, it's a bunch of tools, and they're all free, is the Night Lab. The Night Lab, what they do is they develop tools that you can use for showing different types of data in different ways. So they are storytelling tools, and here are four of them. I'll start with the one on the right, on my right, please. So it's on your right too. Is Timeline JS. What it does is when you have your data set, and let's say that your data set is something that's historical. Not all data set is just numerical, sometimes something that happens through time. And you think that's a way to tell the story. You want to tell the story in a chronological way. So Timeline JS, what it does is you can use a Google Sheet, which actually is actually based on a Google Sheet. And you can click on part of the Google on the Google Sheet and create a little text box. You can put images. You can put basically create something that looks more like a slideshow without having to waste any time. You don't have to do anything. You just copy and paste information there, and it shows. So, for example, this is one of the examples. And you see how there is a timeline in the bottom. And if you just... I can just make this fun. And it shows. And again, it can be anything. Sometimes you can actually show for the Google Map, and it already shows here automatically. You don't have to do all the work of embedding. It embeds automatically. So all you have to have is the the website, the link. It does that same thing with Wikipedia. If you have the link to the Wikipedia, it already shows the image that's on the Wikipedia there too. Of course, you have to be careful with what you're showing from Wikipedia, but it's something that you can do that doesn't take time. Basically saves you time, and you put a really good output for you to put on a website. Another thing that's interesting about the NightLab tools is that they're all embeddable in any website, especially WordPress, but any kind of website. And you don't have to just use one. You can mix them. For example, you can get the story map, which is a map or a picture. It doesn't have to be the map they have there. You can actually embed your own map, or sometimes you're using historical maps. That's what we're building now in our organization. But you can also use a picture to tell the story. So you can actually upload a picture and tell the story based on a specific picture. But what it does is it allows you to embed all types of media. So you click on any one of these here. Let me see. And you can have a video in there. So remember that Videolicious, not the Videolicious, well, I'm going to show that later. But the verse.com, you can actually embed here the result. And you can have that playing in your story map. You can embed the storyline here. So sometimes you're telling something, one part of it is historical, so you want to show evolution on that one piece, and you can embed here. Or the opposite, you can actually also embed the story map into the timeline, which also can be done on any website. So again, any type of media. And you see how it shows everything is already pulled from other websites. So this one was pulled from Storify, for example. And let's see if I have one. Yes. So the question is if this works on WordPress website. Yes. You have to sometimes, it depends on the WordPress, sometimes you have to do an adaptation, but the tutorial is very, very simple. It's just one or two lines that you have to change, and it's very, very easy to do. The tutorial shows you how to do that. Again, students, my students look at this and they start playing with this automatically. That's how easy it is. Another thing that the NightLab does is these two other ones that are SoundSight and Juxtapose. And again, you can use all of them together. For example, sound sites, it's not something that's going to tell the whole story, but you can add to any stories, including the ones that you can put in the story map, for example. And what it does is click on this one highlighted area there, and you can add a sound bite, or you can sound clip. So you're telling a story, and you want to have the voice of the person who's telling that story, a first-person narration, for example, and just add to that specific part. Or you have a really good quote, but in print you don't have that the way the person said it, but you have that recorded. So you can actually put that recording, that quote being said the way it was, because it's very different to say no, or say no, or something like that. And it changes the story, right? And you want to capture that, so SoundSight allows you to do that. And again, you can just upload the clip or just link to SoundCloud, and it automatically picks that clip and put it in there. So it's very, very simple to use. And the last one is Juxtapose, which is also very, very simple. And it's really cool because I saw many, many stories that people have to do this, and sometimes they had to actually work a lot of coding to do this, to look the way this one actually looks. Basically what it does is you upload two pictures of the same place, or it could be any two pictures that you want to compare. And in this case is one from 2005, the other one from 2013. And all you do is slide one on top of the other, and you see the same place as different. All of you can see how this applies to environmental stories, right? If you talk about degradation, if you talk about recovery, if you talk about pollution, you can show how a site was at some point and how it became later on. And again, very, very simple. All you have to do is edit the pictures to be more or less on the same size. And once you upload, you have those pictures there. And you can put that in any website, in any kind of platform. Everything is embeddable. They have embeddable codes. So you can use it very, very easily. The next one I want to show to you, and this I think you can actually see better in your phones. If you have a phone, then just go to Videolicious. They have a really cool 1 minute video explaining how it works. But basically what it does is you record clips. For example, you're in a live situation where you're recording a bunch of different clips and you don't have much time to edit the whole thing together. So Videolicious does that to you. What you do is you just click on the videos, you choose the order you want the videos to appear. You can trim the videos right there, and then you click on it, and it plays from beginning to end, and you can record your introduction, and you record your signature in the end, and it does all that in seconds. One thing that I'm going to say about Videolicious is that they have a paid version, and they have a free version. We use the free version because we don't need that right live situation where you have to have everything done. The difference between the paid and the free one is that the paid, you can already include your logos in the beginning and it doesn't show Videolicious. So you already can do that. But what we do is we do the free one and then we put on a video editor and add our logo in the beginning and in the end. And that's it. That's all you need. And you can even use a video editing tool on your phone. So you don't have to actually use a laptop or anything like that. So this is very useful when you're on the go, especially for streamers, and you need to produce something really fast. So again, you can have the free version and might be good enough for most people. This one is actually very, very interesting when you talk about data. It's a data wrapper. Let's say you don't have a graphic designer in your room and you're not very good with data visualization, or you don't have one of those very expensive tools that do data visualization in a way that looks professional. Some of them will give you some graphics that just don't look very nice. This gives you a very simple way for you to choose what kind of data, how to present your data. So you're going to upload your data there, but you can just choose what you want it to look like. So stack bar, map. And just by clicking on things on the options, you can choose the colors, you can choose the labels, you can choose everything you want. There's donut and table here too. So you really can just click on it and you can choose what you want to do with the visualization part of it. So basically it's a copy and paste. So remember when you in the first session we talked about cleaning your data a little bit, you might have to do that to simplify your data for this. But it's very, very simple. You just copy from your spreadsheet, you upload here, and then you choose how you want to present it. And you can even choose how it looks like and choose the colors, and that's it. Done. And it looks good enough that you can present to your editor saying, well, I put some extra effort in this, maybe you should pay me more. And it probably will take you just a few minutes. So think about freelancing. Every single minute counts, right? You're charging for your time. Your time matters. So all these tools, they do that. There are a few more that I'm going to put in the sheet, but they are less visual, they can help. For example, Pablo is for people who use social media. It's like Canva. I don't know if you have ever heard of Canva. But what it does is it creates really cool infographics for you to put on social media very, very fast. Pablo is just faster than Canva. It's just something that's all ready to go. You just choose your template, put your information there, and it shows. Another one that I actually got from Ren LaForme was the Infogram. Basically, it's a site that does graphic design for you. So again, you're looking for what you're trying to do. This takes a little more time, but a lot less time than if you have to start from scratch, or if you, and it doesn't cost us, it has some paying levels, but they are usually very, very cheap. And you just upload your data and it shows you a bunch of different types of infographics that you can use to show your data in a way that's very easy to understand. CrowdTangle, it's a little bit different. This is for you to know if people are actually looking at your stuff. When I talked to Ren, he told me that there is a wait list, so sometimes you have to call them, and eventually they will put you in there. What it does is, if you have your social media linked to your website, They do analytics about specific things in your social media to see who is actually reading your story. So they give you the information about who is actually seeing what you're doing. So you can sell, use that also to sell your stories or to sell yourself when you are looking for a job or looking for a gig. And link checker is also, see, it checks who's sharing your stuff on social media. So you also can use this one to take care of your copyrights, make sure that nobody's sharing your stuff without giving you credit, but also see the reach of your work, because sometimes you are reaching, let's say 1,000, 2,000 people with your work, but you don't know how many people they are reaching with your work. So this one keeps a track. It's like a bot that goes with your work and keeps track of everything that you do. And last thing, this I actually got very recently, is the International Center for Journalism. Let me go back here. And they are working with Knight Fellowships and the IJNet. They create this page, so called tools.ijnet.org. And they have, here there are dozens and dozens of different tools, and depending on what you're trying to do, the tools may work. Some of them are very specific. There are a lot of things here for international place, but if you're doing international reporting, and for example, you go to Africa, to South America, and you're looking for startup data sets or data visualization that you, just for you to start get, to know what you're doing when you get there, they have all the links here. But they also have some really interesting information, for example, Aleph, in a way to get your data there, out there. Digital security kits for journalists and bloggers. So if you are here and you missed the session that was the concurrent session in the other room, you can go here and at least learn something about how to protect your information, how to protect yourself online. And some of them are really interesting, but very specific. So all these, for example, ideas for a hackathon. One thing that my room, newsroom is doing is that we are producing a database, it's a historical database that we want later, once we launch next year, we want to do hackathons to actually put the historical information that we are finding into mainstream websites. So the students are going to be doing that. We are working with local schools and doing these hackathons. So this helps you think, well, how can we get the data that I found out there? How can we get that not to be just one story, but actually a service to people who actually need to get information in multiple ways? So you have dozens and dozens of different types of tools here. So that's where I want to end my part of the presentation. And now I would like to open for questions, but for everyone, you can ask a question to any of the presenters or to myself if I can answer them. So please just identify yourselves, and I'll try to repeat the question. So, David? And just to add to that comment too, my university does that too, but the county also has the historical pictures. They do all these aerial photographs since 1925, so we are using those and actually do comparison decade by decade, so see how things develop. And also David mentioned that when you're doing the comparison, you can use, of course, Google Maps and Google Earth, but sometimes they're a little bit outdated. And nowadays, a lot of people have drones. So you could use your drone to, or someone else's drone. Sometimes it's cheaper to just borrow someone else's. If it's legal, just check that too, because you know, I know when I was in Virginia, you couldn't use those. But if you can use a drone, you can also take those pictures and do the comparison too. Any other questions? Yes. Okay, the question was that if there is a way to use CrowdTangle to, especially new small newsrooms, to promote the stories or open it for other platforms. CrowdTangle, usually what it is going to do is give you the information you need to think about it. I mean, it gives you information where your stories are already going. So it's not going to necessarily open doors for you with other platforms, but at least you know where it is, so you can start thinking how you can reach those platforms. If you want to hit the social media in multiple ways, but without wasting time in doing one story for each one of them, you can use tools like Hootsuite or Buffer. There are two platforms where you can write your story just once, and it already adapts to the media, to the social media you're sending. So they work with Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I'm not sure if they are using Snapchat already, but they at least those three main ones. So you just need to write it once. You don't have to rewrite the story for each one. Hootsuite, like a hoot and like the owl. S-U-I-T. Any other questions? Okay, so this is it for this session. I hope you got something useful for you from everything. At least I learned a lot. And I want to thank the panelists, Lisa Song and Jamie Hopkins. And one last thing, I'll try to get all the materials that we've showed to you today, and we'll put it on the website. So if you didn't get everything, it's going to be there. It takes a few weeks sometimes to be everything on the SCJ website, but it's going to be there. So thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you.